miles of black ribbon on the lone highway. Men turn into boys on the lone highway. Rest up creeps die on the lone highway. Pretty girls beware out on the lone highway. On the lone highway. Little honey on the lone highway. Left me for another on the lone highway. They killed Dirty Dog McGee on the lone highway. Stroked a little girl's hair on the lone highway. On the lone highway.
Hello and welcome to Operation Scorpio. Today's date is February 13, 2021. And welcome to the free range open air insane asylum we call Earth. Well, guys, here we are. Here we are in the era of COVID. That's what they're calling it, the era of COVID, where emotions and fear rule the populace. Critical thinking and rationality are pretty much out the window at this point. And fear and loathing are the order of the day. Who knew Hunter S. Thompson would become something more than just a clever writer, that he would become a prophet? Oh, yes. Fear and loathing are the order of the day. Yeah, guys, the zombie hordes of maskers are becoming more angry. Have you guys noticed this lately? There's a bit of a difference in their attitudes now. They're angrier by the day as their brains are deprived of that precious oxygen, and they, you know, slip deeper and deeper into a self-induced coma. Yeah, guys, have you noticed the increase in anger? And of course, the anger coming from these faceless people, you know, the eyes without a face crowd. Yeah, eyes without a face. That gives a different meaning to the old Billy Idol song from the 1980s, doesn't it? Yeah, the object of their loathing, their fear and loathing, are the barefaced deplorables who refuse to comply with the latest fashion trend. Oh, yeah. You're killing people, they'll tell you as they shuffle off in a state of oxygen deprivation, unable to think clearly and their minds overloaded with fear and loathing. Yeah, fear and loathing. And also, you know, a form of hyper-emotionalism is taking over as well, isn't it? Essentially weaponized emotionalism, right? I mean, I'm seeing it all over the world where emotion trumps rationality. And it's become sort of a ubiquitous part of our culture, you know, you know, everything from the daily dose of the crying nurses on the mainstream media, almost every day, a crying nurse, talking about the bodies piling up at the hospitals, on the sidewalks, and in the refrigerated trucks, And of course, you know, this this hyper emotionalism has now been extended. It's been extended into this theater of the absurd that we see in this impeachment trial, huh? Yeah, the impeachment trial, a theater of the absurd. And I'm not going to spend too much time on this, but I want to look at this impeachment trial from just a little different perspective than what I hear most people saying. And to be honest, guys, I really don't have a dog in this fight, because from where I sit now, I see this federal government as a criminal organization and really nothing more. And the president, let's be honest, guys, is really just a cheerleader for the agenda and a salesman. And it doesn't really make a whole lot of difference whether or not your favorite guy is in there or not. You know, if there's one thing the Trump presidency has taught us, is that the president really can't do much to contradict the agenda, whether or not Trump was 100% sincere or not. That's debatable. But I really do believe this federal government is beyond salvation. It's beyond reform or any kind of redemption at this point. I think we crossed that Rubicon a lot longer ago than we thought. It's just becoming more patently obvious now. And hopefully more and more people are seeing that. But anyway, you know, these Democrats really are making absolute fools of themselves on several levels. And it's just interesting to observe how tone deaf all of these politicians are now on both sides of the aisle. And on one level, it's really surreal to look at these politicians and to hear them speak, because they truly live in a different reality, a different paradigm, and even a different universe, I dare say. Yeah, a different universe. They really live in their own alternative reality. And it's a reality that's completely devoid of the kind of reality the average person faces every day. So make no mistake, this impeachment trial really is just an attack on free speech. And that's really about all it is. And, you know, honest to God, guys, I think it's time to quit thinking about Trump, whether you loved him or you hated him. And, you know, if anyone out there, you know, who's listening, that thinks it's going to make any difference at all if Trump runs in 2024 or not, if you really think that's going to make any difference, I think you're kidding yourself. You know, are you really going to sit around for 4 years and wait for your savior while a wrecking ball is taken to the United States, a wrecking ball to our economy, to our people, and our culture? And believe me, if they're allowed to enact this agenda without serious resistance, we are not going to recognize the country in 2024. I can guarantee you that. You won't recognize it. So yeah, this is really just an attack on free speech and on words. And what they're trying to do is show the public that if you say something wrong, if you use the wrong words, you will be terminated. Your career will come to an end. And furthermore, you must be punished. They keep saying he has to be held accountable for the bad things he said. And really, we're seeing this sort of attack all over the world. It's a global phenomenon, a global agenda, and really a global attack on free speech. And, you know, I just caught the other day that, you know, this, it's kind of funny in a way, the, Tokyo Olympic director, I don't remember, recall his name offhand, but you know, the guy that's running the, Tokyo Olympics, he recently said that, he's running the Tokyo Olympic Committee, and he recently said that, this is kind of funny. He said that the women on the Olympic Committee talk too much. Wow. Who would have thought women talking too much? That's a shocker. And he had to even apologize and resign from his position. And of course, you know, you can take offense to that. But let's be honest, guys, what man hasn't had that thought, at least secretly, at one time or another in his life? And, you know, let's be honest, too. There's plenty of things about men that women find annoying. And I'd say the list is actually fairly long there. And I accept that. That's okay. And it's part of, you know, what we used to just call the differences in the sexes. And really, you're just supposed to enjoy those differences and not get all worked up about it. But instead, you know, this guy had to resign. And in a more sane world, you know, you just, the guy might say, well, hey, you know, maybe I shouldn't have said that. I was kind of joking partly anyway. No big deal. People would laugh it off and that'd be about the end of it. But no, this man had to resign in shame. But first he had to give a remorseful apology and confess to his thought crime. It was really kind of pathetic and sad. So he resigned and was sent into virtual exile and shame over some words he said that most people would admit, at least privately, that is partly true. And so what? So yeah, the big picture though is it's a very dangerous world where a couple of wrong words ends your career. And that is the big picture of this impeachment trial, isn't it? Trump said some wrong words. He has to be held accountable. It's a threat to our democracy, guys. Yeah, everything's a threat to our democracy, isn't it? It's just amazing. And when did people become so weak and easily triggered? That's the part I find sad. So really, this whole case against President Trump is that he said something like, you know, you've got to fight like hell or pretty soon you're not going to have a country. I'm paraphrasing. That's pretty close to what he said. And let's be honest, that's pretty much a true statement there, isn't it? Yet somehow we're supposed to believe that these words are so repugnant and dangerous that he must be punished. Yeah. And, you know, in response, it's kind of funny. The defense team released a video that was actually pretty funny, you know, with all these clips edited together of Democrats saying the same thing. You have to fight. We got to fight, 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 fight. And yeah, that was funny and a little clever. But of course, the Dems like to leave out this little fact that Trump even said that you must protest peacefully and patriotically in the same speech. But, you know, here's the thing I want to really stress. Let's not fall into this trap of dissecting someone's words and then, you know, deciding whether or not they were acceptable or not. This is a big trap that's being set for all of us. For all of us. And on another level, you know, who really cares what President Trump said? The man's a politician. Politicians say all kinds of things in an effort to help their political careers and feather their own nests, don't they? Really, you should take anything a politician says with a pretty big grain of salt. And really, either you have free speech or you don't. That's really the bottom line. You know, even if Trump had said, go storm the Capitol, does that really matter? I mean, did the people who heard this speech have free will or not? I mean, did they suddenly become robots under some kind of mind control? And ultimately, wasn't everybody there responsible for their own actions? What a concept, huh? And it was kind of funny, you know, on Mike Gatti's show yesterday, Dare to Think Out Loud, which Mike sort of jokingly postulated that the show should be renamed Dare to Think. I think there's some truth in that, isn't there? Given the world we currently live in. But anyway, during the show, the concept of limitations on free speech came up in the conversation, and it was an interesting set of discussion points, really. And of course, this thing that we've all heard, you know, you can't shout fire in a crowded theater. You know, everyone's heard that. And, oh, yeah, no, of course not. You can't say that. No. Well, if you think about it, why not? Why should that be, you know, accepted without thinking about it that, oh, that's dangerous speech? Why? Because 9 lawyers in a robe said it was. That's it. End of discussion. These 9 lawyers that are wearing black robes, they said so. That's it, guys. And think about it. You know, if you're sitting in a theater and some idiot says, hey, there's a fire. Well, what are you going to do? I mean, are you going to just react like some unthinking animal and panic and, you know, run over everybody as you try to get yourself out of the theater as quickly as possible? Or, you know, do you look around and observe your surroundings like a thinking individual and then observe, hey, is there smoke? Do I smell smoke? Do I see any smoke? Is there a fire anywhere? No, it's dark in here. I don't see a fire. Well, you know, in a more sane and responsible world, someone would just tell that guy, hey, settle down. I'm trying to watch the movie here. And then you'd go about watching the movie. And that would be about it. But this is the example where you're supposed to, oh, my God, you can't do that. That's dangerous, crying fire in a crowded theater. We're just supposed to accept these dictates because some lawyers in a black robe said so. Amazing. And now, of course, not only speech is under attack, but ideas. Right? Because we're hearing, oh, the conspiracy theories are a threat to our democracy. They're dangerous. We can't have these conspiracy theories. That's one of the new mantras we're hearing, how so-called conspiracy theories are threatening our democracy. And again, if you think about what is a conspiracy theory, well, usually it's just an idea that questions the official narrative of some major event. And that's pretty much about all it is. And again, if it's a goofy conspiracy theory with no evidence to back it up of any kind, it'll be quickly discarded by any rational thinking person. They'll figure it out all on their own. Wow, amazing. But somehow it threatens our democracy. Oh, yeah. The temple of our democracy, as Nancy Pelosi's been putting it lately. This, our temple of democracy. And this, a woman, Nancy Pelosi, who is a second generation mafia criminal. You know, her father was the governor of Maryland, among other things. And if you look into it, her father was closely connected to the Jewish mob. Oh, yeah, on multiple levels. A lifetime criminal who gave birth to a second generation lifetime criminal, Nancy Pelosi. Yeah. And the other thing that's interesting about this temple of our democracy, one little thing I heard on PBS, and I kind of like PBS because it's so pompous. You know, the commentators are so pompous and full of themselves. Yes, we're a little more intellectual here at PBS than their average news show. It's just a bunch of mindless pomposity. But anyway, they were reporting on this so-called impeachment trial, right? And they said that the trial is going to recess on Saturday. On Saturday. To observe the Jewish Sabbath. Okay. Well, that's fine. But then they go on to say that the trial is going to resume on Sunday. Can you believe that? They're putting it right in our faces. Yeah. Not going to observe the Christian Sabbath, but oh, the Jewish Sabbath, that's important. We're doing that, guys. Amazing. And they said it, you know, right there on PBS in front of God and everybody. As one of my seventh grade teachers used to say back when I lived in Texas, I'm going to say it right here in front of God and everybody, she used to say. That'd probably get you fired now, wouldn't it? Yeah, right in our faces, guys. And then did you guys see this clown? Senator Raskin is this Jewish fellow that's one of the men that's spearheading this so-called impeachment trial. He began to cry, crocodile tears, more hyper-emotionalism. And it was about the fakest damn thing I've seen since President Obama cried some fake tears when he was talking about Sandy Hook. Remember that, guys? And he even wiped away a tear that wasn't there with his finger. No tear, but he wiped it. Yeah, so this Raskin character, he starts crying because his daughter was supposedly with him on that fateful day where the unwashed masses entered the Capitol building. And he said that now she's too afraid to ever return to the Capitol building because of what happened on that day. She's just too afraid, guys. She's terrorized, traumatized for life now. Yeah, and he did the little routine where he pretended to wipe away a tear. It was bad acting. Let's just say that. Yes, because of this, you know, mob of unwashed goyim who dared to enter the temple of their democracy. Yeah. Hyper-emotionalism, guys. It's everywhere. And it's being used to manipulate us. That's about all there is to it, isn't there? And in more hyper-emotional news, I saw a interview with Senator Patty Murray, who is a senator from Washington. Since 1993, that's a pretty long run, isn't it? What, 29 years? Not bad. And she gave her harrowing account of this terrorizing ordeal when the unwashed masses, the hoi polloi, entered into the temple of our democracy. And of course, she began to cry during this account, more hyper-emotionalism to sell the story. And she claims, this is so funny, guys, she claims that she heard the mob chanting, freedom, 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 as they walked down the halls. And then here's the part that I find humorous. She said she heard the mob say, kill the infidel, kill the infidel. Yeah, right. That's not a manner in which any kind of average American speaks, is it? You know, just pure, unadulterated, well, prefabricated bullshit, essentially. And then, of course, she calls her staff because she was in such terror. And the staff members told her to put on her gas mask. Find your gas mask, they told her. So she started crawling on the floor looking for her gas mask. What a coward. These are our leaders, people. And then she said she didn't know where it was because they hadn't had to use their gas mask since 9/11. Yeah, not since 9/11. And, you know, she said she was in terror, just like on 9/11. And, you know, it was just interesting to observe the fear and loathing she had towards the people that she supposedly represents. And, you know, I just looked this up. Fun fact, there's 5,723 Senate staff members in total. So there's 5,723 assistants and people helping the Senate function. And each senator has between 5 and 6 personal assistants. You know, people that run errands, get them coffee, whatever their little heart's desire, right? And then this is the other part that just really killed me. She went on to say that during 9/11, we had the resolve to fight terrorism, but we don't have that resolve now to fight domestic terrorism. And I just found this so fascinating on several levels. You know, one, she's been a senator for, 29 years? And this woman was completely tone deaf about how she might appear to the average person telling this bogus story. And it's clear, you know, she's lived in this world where her power is never questioned and where her actions never have consequences to her personally. And sort of a world where she only has to have contact with the hoi polloi every 6 years, you know, to shuck and jive and get reelected every 6 years. So really, this woman is so out of touch that the people frighten her and terrorize her. They're revolting to her. Yeah. And she wants to fight domestic terrorism, which really, if you think about it, guys, it's a declaration of war on the people. That's about all it is. And then, you know, as the interview came to a close, she went on to say that we have to unite the country, you know, that old song and dance. And exactly how that was going to happen, she didn't make clear. It pretty much sounded to me like, you know, either you do what you're told or you're a domestic terrorist. And it's so funny. She said, we don't want brute force to be, you know, how this country is ruled. I just found that odd because what does she think the police do every day? They use brute force. What does the military do every day? Well, it's beyond brute force. Really, what she was saying is she wants to keep her monopoly on brute force. Only the state can use brute force. And again, another let them eat cake moment. And many more are soon to follow. I can guarantee that. Because you look at these politicians on both sides of the aisle, they are completely out of touch. It's staggering, really. And also, this is another side effect of these politicians who have bought into globalism. They don't think about the people in their own country. They sort of just see the world as this grand chessboard, as Brzezinski's put it. And they really don't give a rat's ass about the people in their own country. And that's becoming transparent, let's say. Yeah, just amazing. And here's something to kind of end my rant with that I found kind of funny. This leader of Tanzania, John Magufuli, the president of Tanzania, it's kind of funny, man. He recently took $27 million in aid, in COVID aid, from the European Union. And he was supposed to buy, you know, PPE, personal protection equipment, and to purchase vaccines and masks and implement the COVID agenda with this money, right? But it's kind of funny. Instead, a few days later, he declared that there's no COVID in his country. He kind of took the money and run, didn't he? And he said that he became suspicious about these so-called PCR tests and actually took the initiative to look into it on his own. And maybe you guys have already heard the story. You know, he took a sample from a papaya and a goat and some motor oil. All came back positive. It's kind of funny in a way, isn't it? And of course, the EU is outraged that he's not following the WHO health dictates. And that's interesting, you know, just the assumption that every country should follow the so-called WHO World Health Organization dictates, as only they have the proper way to proceed. And of course, this is the unveiling of world government, isn't it? And also, Tanzania does have a very low COVID rate, and it's partly because you can buy hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin over the counter without a prescription for malaria and other parasites. And it's interesting that somehow these anti-parasite drugs and the drugs that work on malaria seem to have a positive effect on so-called COVID. And there's quite a bit of research to back that up. I'm going to have a guy on the show soon, this guy from Colorado, that has read through hundreds of pages of research on ivermectin, which is really just an anti-parasite drug, and how powerfully effective it is against COVID. And, you know, in many countries in Africa and South America, people that live in the jungle will take hydroxychloroquine once a week as a preventative for malaria. It's quite common, actually. The nickname for it is the Sunday pill. You take it once a week on Sundays. And isn't that interesting how it's been so demonized? And, you know, here in Ecuador, the president just issued a health order to make ivermectin prescription only. A drug that you really can't abuse. It's not like you can smoke it and get high from it. And of course, Ecuador, like most third world countries, are in debt to the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. And part of the requirements to get your hands on the shekels is that you have to agree to follow all World Health Organization dictates. But isn't that amazing? They want to limit people's options. You know, they want to limit their options. There's only one way to deal with this. There's only one way to deal with COVID. That's the vaccine, lockdowns, masking, gloves, social distancing, and vaccines. That's the only way forward, guys. Or so they want us to believe. That said, I would like to introduce my co-host and my main man, Mr. Giuseppe from the District of Criminals. And I believe we have Brutal Honesty, Chris Weinert, with us as well. Hello, guys. How's it going?
Hey, Dave. How are you?
Okay.
Living the dream. Excellent
points made in your introduction well stated.
Yeah.
Yeah, so many things I could go off on, but yeah, I think we probably want to keep it short, right? We got, it sounds like you got an action-packed guest list today.
Yeah, well, we're going to bring the guests on the top of the second hour, so we got about 20 minutes just to shoot the breeze.
Yeah, right on.
I'm hearing an echo now, though. Is anyone else hearing that?
Yeah, I got it.
All right. All righty. Yeah, man, it's insane. The globalist cancer is just stage four advanced with this country now. And if people don't wake up, and I don't foresee them waking up, it's all lost. It's all lost.
Yeah. And this big picture of the global attack on free speech, I think, is very significant. And we're seeing it on all fronts.
Yeah, it's a massive power play by the oligarchs to literally lock down their massive herd of 7.3 billion Goyim cattle. There he is.
Yeah.
Try it again, Chris.
Still getting an echo? A little bit?
Yeah. Do you have headphones on?
Yeah, I'll go. Hold on. I'll mute out and I'll put them on. I'll come right back.
Okay, I'm going to drop out and come back too, because someone's saying I have echo also, so I'll be right back.
This is Giuseppe. I've taken on control. We are in control. There's my Al Haig imitation for those of you old enough to remember when Ronnie Reagan survived his assassination attempt and General Al Haig stepped in and took control. So anyway, they should both be back here shortly. Here's Scorpio. Try it again.
Okay. Can you hear me?
I mean, it sounds fine to me.
Yeah, I don't hear it now.
Chris, are you there? Are you there, laddie? Oh, he was going to get headphones. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really something else, Scorpio. I never thought in my life that I would see a nation of cowards so willingly accept the destruction of their sovereign republic. It's just, they're so mind controlled. They're so mentally weak. They're cowards. They're unable to critically think. They have no real spiritual practice. They're just weak in every aspect of the word and the sense, and it's an embarrassment. And it's going down quick, it seems.
Well, yeah, and it's just amazing how the entire Western world seems to be, you know, galloping at full speed towards the abyss, both with their culture, their people, their economy, all under this fear and loathing of COVID. And the only countries standing up are so-called third world countries like Tanzania and Belarus and a handful of others that are saying, hey, it's not a problem and we're going to go our own way on this. And I'm just, it's amazing how the West is in such lockstep towards self-destruction.
Yeah, it's insanely embarrassing. I mean, you know, this is World War III, conquering the world, and not a shot has really been fired. Lots of injection shots, and that's probably made people stupid and cowardly, but you know what? What a tragedy! What a joke!
Yeah. Hey, I wanted to ask you. You know, last night you were talking about a friend of yours that had COVID and
right,
the classic symptoms of it. Okay, here's Chris. Are you there, Chris? Okay, well, we'll see. Anyway, I wanted to ask your friend, what was his position on masking? Was he wearing a mask or not wearing a mask?
He thinks they're not necessary, but he wears them as needed to live his life.
Okay, but was he someone that had to wear it like for hours at a time, or just when he goes to the grocery store and stuff like that?
Just grocery store. His employment has him working at home, so he only wears it to like go to a store or what have you.
And does he have any idea where he may have contracted this, or what?
Yeah,
does he have a theory?
Yeah, anyway? From his wife. He knows where he got it. His wife works at a marijuana dispensary, medical marijuana dispensary, and all six of the people who work there got it.
And, oh, so some degenerate pothead gave it to her then, huh?
Goddamn potheads!
Huh. Okay, so that makes sense. Huh. But both of them survived somehow. Neither one of them died or got put on a ventilator.
Well, that's just it. Most people, if you have a healthy immune system, if you don't get that stupid nose rape test, which actually isn't accurate because he had and he tested negative. And so
oh wow.
Yeah, yeah. So shoot. I lost my train of thought. I was looking at the chat room.
The chat room can be distracting, but it's awfully good. That's why you keep looking at it.
Right. I know what I was going to say. Most people who may have it, you just it's a cold unless you're told. If right. there wasn't this mind rape psyop about, oh, COVID-19, people would 99% would have had the cold or flu. And the people who lost their sense of smell and taste, that'd be weird. They'd go to the doctor and they would the doctor be like, this is a weird one, man. I don't know, which is really what they say anyway, except now they're lumping this all in to blaming the novel coronavirus. And, you know, why is it that only a few people get this symptom anyway? So what the hell is going on?
That is strange, and we'll do a sound check on Chris here in just a second. I just want to say one last thing. You said your friend tested negative. I know this woman in San Diego, and she works at one of these sort of alternative health clinics where they do, you know, cleansing and all, you know, colonics and all kinds of, you know, alternative therapies. And there's a new owner of this clinic, and he's making all the employees get tested twice a month. Well, my friend, she's tested positive for COVID three times. And of course they have the employees have to pay for the tests out of their own pocket, by the way, which doesn't seem fair, but she's tested three times, asymptomatic, totally healthy, you know, the kind of woman that goes out and walks an hour and a half a day and, you know, just very, very healthy person. And she's been unable to work for like 6 weeks now.
Unreal.
Yeah. This is like them really running people out of business, out of their livelihoods, out of their homes, and any resistance is terrorism. This should tell you exactly what the heck these people are doing with this doublespeak.
Right.
And they're catering to a certain group selectively, you know, that they're trying to, let's just say, tokenize with these incentive programs, you know, the youth or maybe the minorities that are taking some extremely considerable unemployment stipulations and checks and EBTs and assistance programs. And they're dependent upon the system that they're creating for them. So they have one demographic that they cater their info and their propaganda to in a certain way. We'll call them the left, right? And then you got the Republicans, most of the middle class, that are holding on to their property and trying to, you know, still earn a livable wage and fighting for labor and things like this, but are still, you know, along the industrial class too. So you call them the right, the Republicans. So I think what they're doing here is forcing people into a third camp of helplessness where both two sides are absurdities. Like you say, they're theaters. And it's like the point is to really create a third wave of a minority that they can probably purge out or at least at some point in time, maybe it will develop enough leadership where they'll have to acknowledge it. And maybe that's what the Donald Trump plan is all about, is them putting him in the midst for that. And I think that that's kind of the long play here.
Yeah, we'll see. Good points, Chris. You sound good now, Chris, by the way. No echo at all.
Cool. Good, good.
Yeah, and, you know, man, have you looked at the, you know, now they're saying in some parts of the country they're going to start reopening schools to, you know, regular learning. And it's really sad if you look at these schools. The teacher has a plexiglass, you know, shield in front of her now, and then all of the desks of the kids have, you know, a three-sided plexiglass shield around them. They have to wear masks at school all day. And this is so-called the new normal. And then they have, like, they've already got these different color-coded levels. You know, there's yellow where they can go back to, you know, normal, so-called normal. And there's orange and red. And some schools are going to be, depending on the, you know, they're going to test the kids every 2 weeks or 1 week, I forget which. And depending on the test results, then they'll get a status, you know, either, you know, green, yellow, orange, red. And this is all going to determine whether or not they can go to school or do anything. I'm just astounded by all of this.
Look how they're using like small businesses or teachers or any of these other small middle-class people as instruments to uphold these absurdities too, and putting the onus onto them, not only in their businesses, but even, as you say, as employees, having to go get these ridiculous witch hunt PCR tests and you know, doing this over and over again. It is about compliance and control. It is certainly about not about medicine or helping people or health. This is a total inversion. I've been doing videos about this for the last 5 years, not necessarily the COVID thing, but saying that the Rockefeller Board of Medicine is basically a poison apple or a Trojan horse at best. And as we talked about before the show started, you were yesterday on Giuseppe's show, Jimmy, I believe was his name, was going into a pretty detailed story about some of the young age people that had cancer. And I started thinking, man, what if these vaccines are exactly the instruments that they're delivering these cancers into? And this is the population control, the Georgia Guidestones Deliverance Program, let's just say. You know, this is the thing. People, are you going to say that the Georgia Guidestones are a forgery like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion as they come in and lockstep, you know, in like a century-long plan, the same exact things that are written being manifested into reality under the same propaganda and to benefit the same people who wrote it? I don't know. At some point in time, I don't think it takes Sherlock Holmes to figure out what's going on here. And I'm just surprised that so many people are dumbfounded by what is really going on. And they haven't attributed any malevolence to the forces behind this.
Yeah. And, you know, I believe the Georgia Guidestones were put in there sometime in the 1970s, right? So it shows you how far in advance this has all been planned. This wasn't cooked up last night or last week, you know?
Yeah. Like I was saying yesterday in the show, the 2005 World Bank memo, when Wolfowitz was the president of the World Bank, was talking about the population for the U.S. being under 70 million by the year 2025. So that's a pretty significant one in five makes it, and four out of five go, you know. So it's probably about right if you look at the mask and the vax and the people like trying to jump to the line in that. Man, I could see it really happening. And I just have to say that after they get rid of those people, then they're going to go after the people that knew better, and they probably go after those people first. But I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. Giuseppe, what are your thoughts on all this now?
I think Chris is absolutely right about the contaminants and the toxins and the adjuvants in vaccines causing cancer. And in Jimmy's case and in others' cases, it's that much worse because he was working in installing all kinds of wireless, and he was, you know, exposed to so many toxic frequencies. So that's like a horrible 1-2 deadly punch right there.
Hey, Giuseppe, I was going to say, sorry, Dave, I was going to say, Giuseppe, think about them using the schools and the teachers as a force to uphold the vaccine protocols now with children, and even taking them away from their parents in many cases under the guise of COVID or quarantine or whatever, and then forcing these things onto these kids without the consent of their parents, and in many cases without even their knowledge. So, I mean, this is criminal what is being done here, and the fact that it's not even being mentioned by the politicians, and in fact anybody that's resisting this is being targeted by these politicians, I have to say they've sold us out, and they've obviously spoken for their vested interest instead of their constituency.
Hey, teacher, leave those kids alone.
Yeah.
These teachers are screwed. Look at they have to like learn Common Core. I mean, the suicide rate among teachers has got to be astronomical with just this in itself, and then No Child Left Behind and this whole. I mean, because, you know, people that become teachers do it for ethical purposes, and then having to really go into this system, kind of like doctors too and nurses, you know, they go into these systems and they're just literally liquidation instruments for the poor and the middle class, and there's just two tiers of treatment for the affluent versus the common person. So
I agree.
It's becoming more and more evident.
I agree with everything you said, except that I don't think that there's two there's a divided swath of the teaching herd now. Half of them, in my opinion, go in for ethical reason. The other half are mind raped and go in it because they're color revolution communitarians and want to and train the youth. I think they have an agenda. Look at all these teachers out in Portland and California, in New York State. They are criminal. They shouldn't be teachers.
Oh, they're farming. They're making this and producing these people. You're absolutely right. I'll give you that. Sorry, Dave. Go ahead.
Yeah. And they've already have the precedent that, little kids have to be vaccinated all over the place. So they're already talking about vaccinating the children. And it's interesting, a psychological technique they're using. Whenever they interview a teacher from these teachers unions, they're saying, well, we don't want to go back to work until we have a vaccine. You know, our lives matter, too. We're worried about our health. The little kids are going to kill us unless we have the vaccine. So
they find that one Judas goat teacher, Dave, you know, the guy that's just like, come on, follow me. You know, not the 10 that are going, oh, hell no. You know what I mean? And that's the thing, you know, first responders, you know, professional athletes, there's a lot of resistance in this. And the media is going through hell and high water to just ignore that and to completely sensationalize the compliance. So this is an operation, man.
Wow.
Total psychological operation. In fact, this is World War III, but it's being fought with basically taking over the mind. It's fifth generation psychological operations, and what's insane is yet the old tricks still work. The old internationalist Jew trick of divide and conquer. You've got on the one side the well-meaning patriots who are clueless as to how they're driving themselves their own destruction, and on the other side you've got the shitlib communitarian color revolutionist who is really so self-destructive as far as what they would they should see as their responsibilities as a citizen, and instead they want to live in a totalitarian communist existence, and I cannot believe they don't understand history and what's happened with every other communist country. They're going to be the first to be a shot in the head and thrown in a ditch. It's crazy.
Exactly. Like every liberal government, you've seen these purges come through. If you look at history, great point there. And man, I had another point about what was going on with the liberal agenda and how they're using not only weaponizing these weapons of mass emotional destruction and training them in farms or schools or whatever you want to call this common core to really go after and misappropriate accountability to the other selective token members of the caste system and ignoring the people at the top that are screwing us all. So, I mean, like, it's funny, you know, they could sit here and do this. Like, they keep repeating, like, the themes and the formulas, too. Like, I mean, they had the Orange Riots, the Orangemen Riots, like, and it was the Protestants versus the Roman Catholics amongst the Irish. So this is, like, in the New Lands and stuff like this. They pit the poor against the poor and run the poor against the middle class all the time. They just with groups.
Okay, we're all connected now. Okay, well, you know, really, I kind of want to just kick things off by handing the ball over to Mike Gatti, the Rebel Madman. He recently came up with some very interesting research on Freemasonry and the founding era. And I thought we'd just let Mike kick the ball around where he wants, and then we'll see where it takes us. So, Mike, why don't you go ahead and enlighten us with your research, please?
Well, can you guys hear me okay?
Yep.
Yes.
Do you hear him, Daryl?
Right. Nope.
You don't hear
I
Mike?
Hear everybody. No, I do.
Yep. Oh, okay. Okay, good.
Hey, that's not nice. One of the things, and I realized from catching the last part of the first hour, you guys are talking about a taboo subject in academia America. You do not write about Freemasons. If you write about them, and you are employed in any, probably almost any university in America, you will very shortly be in the unemployment line. It is not, people do not cover it. One of the greatest examples, one of my favorite historians is McDonald from University of Alabama. He wrote three wonderful books, E Pluribus Unum. You know, he wrote books about the American Revolution and, you know, thousands and thousands of pages, not one mention ever of Freemasons. And so it's not an easy topic to actually sort out because even the Masonic historians disagree with each other. And there are two books, though, that deal in detail with the question. And one is by a gentleman named Ronald Heaton, and the other is by a Philip Roth. And if I remember correctly, was it not Mr. Roth's work that I sent to you gentlemen earlier this week?
Yes.
Okay, well, let me start with Mr. Heaton then. The Masonic Service Association published Ronald Heaton's Masonic Membership of the Founding Fathers in 1965. And that book contained detailed biographies of about 200 men of the Revolution, of whom about a third were Masons, and a third may have been. So a possibility of two-thirds of the Founding Fathers being Masons. And Mr. Heaton was very judicious in naming the lodges and source documents for attributing membership to anyone. And he says that 10 of the signers of the original Continental Articles of Association were Masons. 9 of the signers of the Declaration of Independence were Masons. 9 of the signers of the Articles of Confederation were Masons. And 13 of the signers of the Constitution were Masons. 33 general officers of the Continental Army and 8 of Washington's 29 aides or military secretaries were also Masons. So if there was that predominance of Freemasons during the Revolutionary Era, as mentioned in a book titled Masonic Membership of the Founding Fathers, why is this subject not discussed, gentlemen?
Well, that's a really good question. You know, I'm not sure about that. There's a lot of ways you could approach that. You know, one interesting thing, experience I had is, you know, I was able to take this tour of the Supreme Council building in Washington, D.C., which is, you know, the only place you can receive your 33rd degree. And in one of the rooms, they had a little statue of the American Revolution and one of the Civil War where Freemasons were helping each other behind the scenes in both wars. And, you know, they were quite proud of it, saying, well, yeah, they did things to help each other behind the scenes secretly. And I was thinking, well, that's interesting. And, of course, many of the generals during the Revolutionary War were Freemasons as well. So how do you fit that together in this puzzle?
Well, I think it was it's quite telling, and it's even more telling that nobody wants to write about it. That tells me that they're playing whatever his face is on Facebook. They are blotting out information that they don't want people to know about. Why else would you not, if the Masons were so proud of all of these people and having that kind of influence, why isn't it written about? Why do they not want people to write about it? But I will share one story with you, gentlemen, and I'm certainly not going to mention any names, but a longtime friend of mine, he got upset when he attended my classes. He got upset when I mentioned Masons. And he said that, and without going into any detail, he was in prison in a foreign country and may have been there as an operative. I'm not sure. I can't say one way or the other. But he said he was in prison, and actually people from a foreign country came to the prison and took him out to eat because he was a Mason, and they knew he was a Mason. So that, I think, is very telling, and it corroborates what Dave was talking about with the with them helping out each other secretly. And, you know, I just don't understand, but why that they would not want people to know about this. In Heaton's book, there is, well, you know, and he went on to tell me about all of the wonderful things that Masons did about helping children, crippled children, all of the stuff that they did. That there were people who actually flew people to appointments at hospitals at no charge and all the other stuff. And I think that's fantastic. But considering going along with that, why would you not want people to know that you were that you were instrumental in the founding of the country to the extent that Mr. Ronald Heaton mentioned in that book that was published in 1965.
Yeah, Mike, I was going to ask you, have you ever heard anything about the George Washington only having like Masons within his circle, his inner circle of like, say, the Revolutionary Army and things like that? Also, have you heard anything about Cornwallis and his correspondence with Washington at Yorktown, talking about the Masonic Order and things like that?
Yes.
Two things that you might want to shed some light for the viewers.
Obviously, there were Masons on both sides of the fight.
And, like Sham War. Mike, have you ever heard of like this concept of Sham Wars with like King Philip's and King William's War? It's the same concept with that,
right,
where they have, you know, pulling people in, you know, to both sides. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Well, when we go to this this part that I just read from Heaton, 33 general officers of the Continental Army and 8 of Washington's 29 aides or military secretaries were Masons. And there is documented the fact that when Lafayette came over to assist with the Revolutionary Army, with the Continental Army, that before he could command troops, Washington required him to become a Mason. So
right.
I think is very telling. Heaton published quite a list of people who during the founding era who were Masons. And it is fairly extensive and would probably be boring to read it. Do you gentlemen see any value in reading that list?
Why don't you hit upon the highlights at least? I'm fascinated by this. Why don't you do that, and then we'll get Daryl Wayne's take on this, because I'm very interested to see where his mind wants to take this information.
Okay, well, the reason I mentioned this was the Ross, the book that I gave you by Philip Roth, and then this book by Ronald Heaton have some different, some disparity in who was Masons and who was not. In Heaton's book, again, which was sanctioned by the Freemasons, titled, again, pardon my redundancy, Masonic Membership of the Founding Fathers, he mentions Thomas Adams, Benedict Arnold, Hodejah Bayles, Gunning Bedford Jr., Edward Biddle, John Blair, David Barely, Jacob Broom, Daniel Carroll, Richard Carey, Richard Caswell, James Clinton, who was the father of DeWitt Clinton, Jonathan Dayton, Elias Dayton, John Dickinson, who was the author of the Articles of Confederation, but ironically refused to sign the Declaration of Independence, but walked out of the room to make it unanimous so that no one could say that anyone dissented from the Declaration of Independence. John Dickinson walked out of the room.
Hmm.
So, of course, we have Benjamin Franklin, Mordecai Gist, John Glover, John Greeton, John Hancock, Edward Hand, Cornelius Harnett, Joseph Hughes, James Hogan, William Hooper, Charles Humphreys, David Humphreys, Rufus King, Henry Knox, one of the generals who wrote to Washington extensively, especially about the Shays Rebellion, Lafayette, Henry Lawrence, Benjamin Lincoln, another general who wrote to Washington extensively about Shays Rebellion, and basically were behind pushing Washington to attend the Constitutional Convention. James McHenry, William Maxwell, Hugh Mercer, Richard Montgomery, J.P.G. Muhlenberg, which is, you know, he was the Speaker of the first U.S. House of Representatives. Robert Trent Payne, William Palfrey, Samuel Holden Parsons, William Patterson, most of these numbers, most of these names will not be familiar to most Americans, because most Americans might know 5 people they call founders. That's one of the favorite things I do when I get a class, is I ask people to list all of the founders that they know, and most of them know 4 or 5 by name, and that's about it. But that is the product of the public fool system in America. But,
right.
You know, Baron von Steuben, some others, James Mitchell Varnum, of course, George Washington, William Whipple, Otho Holland Williams, William Woodford, David Wooster. But to that list should be added Joseph Warren and Paul Revere of Boston, whose lodge was closely associated with the Boston Tea Party. And James Otis was missing from his list. So is Robert Livingston of New York. And so is John Paul Jones. But also the one that's missing from his list is John Marshall, who was the third Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court and probably did more damage to the original ratified U.S. Constitution than anybody in our history. But that is one of the things, the inn, the pub where a lot of this was hatched, especially the Boston Tea Party, was the Masonic headquarters for the lodge in Boston. And that is kept from most people's knowledge as well. So, D.W., you want to chime in here, buddy?
Yeah, that would...
Can I add something real quick on that? All right, go ahead. Sorry.
No, Daryl, go ahead.
All right. I've had quite a few black and tan beers in that pub. It's called the Green Dragon. And it's an interesting place. It still has a lot of character and charm. So the list that you're reading out, Mike, is quite interesting, and I'd like to have that list. What I find may be more informing people's consciousness is the people that were not on the list. I don't hear Patrick Henry or the Adamses being on there. I would have thought maybe Jefferson might have been on there, but I didn't hear his name either. So the reason I believe that to answer your question in the beginning was why don't they want the population, the voters, to be informed of this is for exactly the very same reason that Carol Quigley was castigated and ostracized after his publication of Tragedy and Hope. The fact of the matter is that all the important people already know who's who, and this is called fraternity. And so if we're talking about Freemasonry, we really can't have much of a discussion unless we understand what their motto means: equality, liberty, and fraternity. And we seem to be struggling under those premises at the present. So that's my tip in. Thank you.
Oh, interesting. Chris, go ahead and let it rip, man. I know you wanted to jump in there. Go ahead, man. Okay, he seems to have stepped away. Giuseppe, well, let's hear your thoughts on the discussion at hand here.
Well, my knowledge is pales before the Rebel Madman, so I just find it fascinating. Mm-hmm. Turn it over to him.
Yeah. Chris, are you back? I know you wanted to jump in, man. Go ahead. Okay. All right, he'll be back soon, I'm sure. Well, Daryl, you know, your take on things is always interesting to me, and you sort of took the opposite approach as to who is not on the list, and that would be an interesting correlation to make between, you know, like how many anti-federalists are on that list, I would wonder.
Now you're starting to understand my thinking a little bit. I always go for the opposite. Some people refer to this as a dialectic. This has been a systemic and endemic cognitive problem inside of almost all Americans for generations now, is they only have a perception of one side of the conversation and can only hold one thought or idea in their brain at one time, and because they abhor contradictions. And so life is full of contradictions, but they don't want to contend or deal with it. So they find the most the path of least resistance as far as any narrative goes. This has been done historically, and it's part of human nature. So if you were to take the people that weren't on the list and then compare that to the list who were the anti-federalists and then the ones that were Masons, I think you would find there would be crossover, but I think you would find that the anti-federalists were more on the side of the non-Masonic and that the Federalists were pro-Masonic. That's my supposition. What do you think, Mike? Am I going too far with that?
That's a good line of thought.
Yeah, and I thought you brought up an interesting point too, Daryl, with Carol Quigley and how there is certain information that's deemed to be, okay for the public to know, and there's other information that's deemed not for public consumption.
Well, sure. I think maybe the very best illustration of this that would be in recent memory and accessible to the audience is JFK's secret society speech. Well, can we have this conversation without – who's he talking about? Well, I would suggest he's talking about these very people. If there is anything more anti-American and the espoused values of American, it would be Freemasonry and its secretiveness. There's only one reason why you keep something a secret, because it's not worthy or too filthy to be exposed to the population, the people. That's the only reason you do it. That's why they use pedophilia, pederasty, homosexuality. Oh, wait a minute. That doesn't count anymore. That's if you're a homosexual now, you're a noble American. That's the epitome of being a noble American. So, but secret societies are like a dual citizenship. This is anti-American. It's a contradiction in terms. If you can't cognize that, if you can't relate to that, then you're lost already. You shouldn't even be listening to this. Okay. Yeah. So, I don't know. Mike, bail me out here. I'm getting wound up.
Well, one of the things that I think we should look at, and it seems to be we're missing the elephant in the room, was that if two-thirds of the delegates to the Constitutional Convention of 1787 in Philadelphia were in fact Masons, then does it not fit in perfectly with the fact that it was a secret meeting, no one was allowed in, and they took an oath for 50 years not to discuss what they had done at the Constitutional Convention?
Well, I say, the obvious answer is yes. This is absolutely consistent with the standing operating protocols of a secret society. You know what this sounds like to me, Michael, Dave, Giuseppe, Chris? This sounds to me like Chatham House rules. You know what that sounds? That's what that sounds like. Chatham House rules. I know you guys are all familiar with that.
Right.
Yeah.
Chatham House rules.
A little bit.
What's said here stays here. Nobody gets to know. Chatham House rules is what governs the Council for Foreign Relations, which is a fifth column think tank inside of your country that people ignore, and the Tri-Rattles. They're also Chatham House rules. So, we have all kinds of secret societies going on here.
Yeah, the Bilderberg Bohemian Club. And Skull and Bones, and there's also a lot of quasi-Masonic groups that would fit into this category too. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of, like, the Jesters, for example. They're a quasi-Masonic club, and you can't join unless you are a Shriner, and you can't be a Shriner unless you're a 32nd degree Mason.
Yeah. Well, all Masonic groups, all Masonic orders go to They're in a pyramid structure as well, but there is they're organized under one grand Masonic organizing structure. So they like their pyramid schemes, so even though they like to confuse you with, oh, it's this order, or it's a York Rite, or it's a Scottish Rite, or it's a Blue Rite, or it's the Red Rite, they're always giving you the Riot Act, right? And this is to discombobulate you, to make it so complicated that it's not capable of being comprehended or understood. It's very simple. These are all distinctions without a difference. That's the bottom line for you. It's all organized under one banner, and they're all accountable, although they all do have their separate jurisdictions. It's like a carved out territorial, autocratic, aristocratic jurisdictions of official responsibility. Doesn't this sound a little bit like the feudal system with lords and barons and the lord of the manor here, and this person had this jurisdiction? Well, this is exactly what it happens, but they've carved up the whole world, the corporate world, the legal world, the lawful world, the government world. It's all been carved up. They all have their different jurisdictions, and they all report to the same head. So I need to stop there and let Chris jump in.
Yeah. Go ahead. I know you're eager to jump in, man. Go ahead.
Yeah, I've been chomping at the bit, but trying to be a more patient listener. But yeah, there's many things you guys are talking about that are triggering so many thoughts in my brain. You guys are spot on.
Oh, you're triggered. Uh-oh.
Yeah, right. Traumatized. No,
but rip it, man.
What's that, Mike? Or Daryl?
Ripping. It's ripping time.
So what I was going to say is, if you remember like the Mexican-American War, like Santa Anna supposedly got out of duress from the handshake. Even Joseph Smith was supposedly trying to make the Mormon shake or the handshake before he was thrown out the window and shot or whatever happened with him. So these are like departmentalized military orders. They're almost like in some natures religious ones, some natures they're political ones, others are educational fraternities. But there is definitely a secret society. And when you guys were talking about the inns and the taverns, you got to look to the City of London and the four taverns, like the Grays, the Lincoln, the Inner and Outer Temple inns of London. These are like where all the barristers and lawyers are initially indoctrinated and trained at. So really, I think that the founding forefathers, most of them were probably lawyers and bar certified lawyers or lawyers with an oath to London, you know, and obviously to this Masonic order as well. So there's another meeting in the aisles that is maybe overlooked and maybe generalized with just the Masons, but it goes to even a bigger departmentalized or infrastructure. So I know I'm rambling a little bit here, but I just want to point out some of these things and let you guys rip.
Let's get Giuseppe. Let's throw the ball over to Giuseppe and see what his thoughts are.
You caught them mic'd out. I was also going to say they use in like the Civil War and the Revolutionary War, there's on both sides of it, there's the Masons. And even if you look into the mining operations settling the frontier and after the Civil War and the railroads and all this stuff, they put both outlaws and lawmen alike are both Masons. And they're both in this terrorist campaign that are running out any competition to the mining operations going on there.
Good point. Good point. And, you know, I thought Daryl made an interesting point about the pyramidal structure of all these organizations. And, you know, I believe that the head Mason in the world is a member of the royal family, in the European masonry anyway. So you have a royal family connection to all this as well.
The Order of the Garter is a big thing. That's like like their inner circle. And they have other orders like Order of the Golden Fleece, Order of the Bath, you know, Order of the Malta Cross and all these other things. So, yeah, I mean, you can get into all these different departmentalizations. But, yeah, they're all seem to – all roads seem to lead to London, Rome, and in maybe even New York or D.C.
Well, Dave, exactly who you're talking about here is Prince Philip. He's still the head of it, and he's in – he's the head of what's called UGLE, UGLE. It's UGLE. You can't make it up, right? And UGLE is an acronym for the United Grand Lodge of England. And if you have not seen the videos where they get 10,000 of these high-ranking esoteric occultists together for their secret handshake sessions, it's pretty impressive that you can bring together 10,000 of these people in England on a yearly basis. So it's still going on. The point of the matter is, I don't want to get lost on this, is that from the very beginnings, the first day, there has been ulterior motives by people who were cloaked, promoting one thing and doing another. And this is the basis of Freemasonry, is to remain secret and exact a secret agenda for a objective. And I hope by the end of the show we get to some understanding of what that objective is. So I'll hold up there.
Well, Daryl, that's interesting. And one of the grand objectives of all Freemasons, of course, is rebuilding Solomon's temple for some reason. And some say, well, that's just a symbolic thing or whatever. But it's just I find that an interesting choice, you know, because of Hiram Abiff and the keeping the secret of Masonry, and how, you know, the widow's son was murdered. But the grand goal is to rebuild Solomon's temple. Maybe you guys could jump in and give your take on that. Why is that?
Like Tyre and Phoenicia are empires that are often ignored by history too, and those are big prominent roles that are lost to you know, at least a few centuries in there in prominence. I don't think there was ever necessarily an Israel like they claim there to be, and a King Solomon necessarily of this land. So I have to put that out there as well. I was also going to ask Daryl something, man, and I totally blanked on it. But it was you said Mountbatten was the guy that was in charge of the Grand Lodge. Have you looked into his brother, the guy that's the CEO, former CEO of Cambridge Analytica, the guy that ran the Brexit and the Trump campaign, or, you know, the company that helped Trump win his thing and the Brexit thing? Just want to point that out, too. Masonic connection.
Well,
there.
Yeah, the Mountbattens are Rothschilds. Okay. That's the almost the beginning and an end of it. I know it's hard to try to elucidate a whole concept by just stating one name, but Mountbattens are Rothschilds. The esoterica of this is just almost beyond some people's comprehension. So Dave was bringing up, he mentions Hiram Abiff. Well, what is that? You know, well, this is another one of the secret language, little winks and words that they use with each other. Since you opened that door, Dave, part of what they're trying to bring forth here is Horus. Okay, they're trying to resurrect Horus, the bringing out Horus again. Well, who is Horus? Horus is the son of Osiris and Isis. So you see all throughout England, obviously the state capital. Not state capital. Well, in state capitals too, but Washington, D.C., the whole architecture and physical layout is with Egyptian symbology and Greek mythological buildings and gods and goddesses and the Panthea. I don't know. Michael, I need you to help me out here. What's the name of that pseudo historian that walks around talking about revolutionary history? What's his name?
David Barton.
Help me, Dave. Thank you, David Barton. I'd like to take him on a tour of the of Washington D.C. Maybe we could open his eyes. I doubt it, though. So, anyway.
Yeah, and
you
know, I took a tour of the Washington Monument, and on the little pamphlet, if you read the little booklet carefully, the Washington Monument is 555 feet high by 111 feet across, which of course adds up to 666. Just a coincidence, I'm sure. Maybe Giuseppe could jump in here. Let's get his thoughts.
Well, you know, the rest of the panel including yourself, the knowledge of the Freemasons and dwarfs my own. I mean, to me, you go back time immemorial and you always have these secret societies from the oligarchs. You know, they're working their machinations. And the one question I have is clearly dating back at least six millennia to the time of Sumeria and Babylon, you've got the Talmudic Babylonian Synagogue of Satan, which certainly devotes themselves to a dark, dark lord. And you've got the Masons, as I understand it, serve a dark lord. But I don't know if it's exactly the same dark lord. There's many lords in the history of empires and gods and what have you. But what's interesting to me, it wasn't it this fella Adam Weisskopf, who was a Synagogue of Satan member who infiltrated the Masons, correct? And all of a sudden, you know, with everything else, the internationalist Jew has now infiltrated that and pretty much taken it over. So, what were your guys' thoughts on that?
Well, I would just add briefly that, you know, Adam Weisskopf, what they decided to do after, you know, their documents were found after one of their couriers was killed, is the strategy was to go in and infiltrate every Masonic lodge and sort of have a circle within a circle within these lodges so that, you know, the vast majority of the members didn't know. But then you had an inner circle of people who did know this infiltration of the so-called Illuminati. And that was the strategy they followed. Probably up until this day is my guess.
Well, there you go. Anybody else, any thoughts on how did this merger occur of two different evil worshiping cadres, and now all of a sudden they're pretty much controlled by the same dark worshipers?
Birds of a feather.
Well,
there you go.
Yeah. I have more to talk about on this, but I think Michael has some more foundational information he'd like to address. If am I right on that, Michael? You'd like to?
The name was mentioned of Patrick Henry, and I believe that Patrick Henry is not very well understood in our history. As a matter of fact, people like the wonderful David Barton, all they want to tell you about Patrick Henry is that he was a Christian. And David Barton will lie through his teeth and say that Patrick Henry supported the Constitution. And when in fact, no one fought harder against the adoption of the Constitution. And probably one of the greatest mistakes was when Patrick Henry refused to attend the Constitutional Convention, stating he smelled a rat leaning towards a monarchy in Philadelphia. Patrick Henry was not one of the elite. He was not of the aristocracy, the founding aristocracy of the country in any way, shape, form, or fashion. He was an old country boy from the western part of Virginia. And he turned the revolution, ignited the revolution with his speech in the Virginia House of Burgesses against the Stamp Act, and he was yelled treason by Edmund Randolph, who was a Mason, and several other members of the Virginia House of Burgesses, saying that, in fact, Patrick Henry was a traitor for daring to go against King George. So I am not surprised that Patrick Henry has not been listed as a Mason. One of the others that I think is... and I consider him to be a voice of reason in the founding era, was Luther Martin. And Luther Martin is nowhere mentioned in any context, anything I have ever found having to do with the Masons. And yet he's the longest sitting attorney general in U.S. history and very much opposed to the Constitution. And he was absolutely incensed at the secrecy clause, and he violated the secrecy clause And that may be the reason he's buried in New York in an unmarked grave, which has been paved over.
Wow.
Didn't they do the same to Thomas Paine, the unmarked grave, and then they dug him up again?
Paine is a real, oh, wow. I don't know how you would say that. He is an enigma wrapped in a conundrum because Paine wrote, you know, and was could be called the penman of the Revolution, but I think that was John Dickinson. But anyway, he was called the penman of the Revolution. Yet when it came time when the Federalists were trying to get their programs through the Articles of Confederation Congress, Robert Morris hired Thomas Paine to write directly opposed to what he had written in his pamphlets. So it appears that Mr. Paine was, you know, a hatchet man for sale.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying, like, what they did with his grave and, like, the unmarked grave and digging him up and moving him like they did with, like, Geronimo, too, and a couple others.
Exactly.
You mean it's sort of a kind of punishment, Chris?
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah. And, you know, another interesting corollary off of this discussion is, you know, the Mormons were briefly brought up earlier. And, you know, all of the founders of Mormonism were Masons. And, you know, the reason that Joseph Smith got himself in such trouble is that many Masons believed that Joseph Smith had revealed too many Masonic secrets. And that's why he was pretty much killed by this mob. And, you know, back when I lived in San Diego, they built one of these giant Mormon temples in San Diego. It was one of these regional centers, an absolute palace. And when it first opened, they allowed people to take tours of it. And so I took the tour, and the building was covered with Masonic symbols. And the way that this church is organized, there's parts of this building that you're not allowed to even go into. Unless, you know, Mormonism has different levels of membership, and you have to be at a certain level before you can even go into parts of this building, much like Freemasonry. So, and the story of Mormonism is incredible. You know, just the amount of followers they had and the impact they had on multiple states within the United States.
Well, what were Smith's last words?
Oh, shit.
Well, not exactly, but his last words were a plea.
Fellow traveler.
Were a plea from the Masonic Creed, hoping that Masons within the group might save him.
Brother, can you save a fellow traveler or something like that?
Something of the, to that nature. I can't remember the exact quote, but I know that it was something from from the Masons' creed, hoping that there were Masons in the group who would save him from his inevitable end.
Yeah. Is there no hell for a widow's son, maybe?
Yeah, that's what it was, yeah.
Yeah. And you know, the impact of Mormonism is really, on the country, is pretty profound, given that it started off as just sort of a small religious sect and you know, went forward into the West and into Nevada. And, you know, the Mormons have a tremendous influence over Las Vegas. Most people don't know that.
The Gold Rush, too, Dave.
Yeah, the Gold Rush.
They were all over Sutter's Farm and all that. Well,
goes back to
Joseph Bobman and that in Utah.
Yeah, they used Chinese slaves to get on the 14th Amendment.
the railroad, Mike, because I don't know about that.
Well, not only that, but Joseph Smith got contracts from both sides, from the Pacific and from the Atlantic side of the. And of course, you've got that great golden rail or spike being put in. But the thing of it is Smith was such an entrepreneur that he got contracts from both sides, and he built parallel tracks so he could charge both of them.
Oh, wow. Wow. And, you know, to be, as I understand it, too, all the high level elders, as they call them in the Mormon church, they're all Masons. You can't get up high in the hierarchy of Mormonism unless you're a Freemason.
Well, let's also not forget for a moment, gentlemen, how heavily recruited the Mormon faith is of federal officers, federal bureaucracies, the FBI, the CIA, the DIA, so many federal, they recruit heavily within the Mormon faith. And when the debacle was taking place in 5 years ago up in Oregon, one of the first questions that Ammon Bundy, when they had a private meeting at the airport with the FBI, one of the first questions from Ammon Bundy to the first FBI member he met was, he says, how many members of the Latter-day Church do we have here?
Wow, that cuts right to the chase, doesn't it?
Yeah, a friend of mine who was actually at that meeting is the one who told me that. He said he was just set back that the very first question out of Ammon Bundy's mouth is, okay, how many Latter-day Saints do we have here?
Well, Mike, why do you think so many Mormons are recruited into these alphabet agencies?
Intertel, too. Sorry, Mike.
Well,
Intertel.
Look at the Book of Mormon. They swear unwavering allegiance to the U.S. Constitution.
Really?
Yes. Look in the Book of Mormon. You'll find it for yourself.
Wow. Chris, go ahead. I know you wanted to jump in there, man.
I was just saying Intertel, like the Howard Hughes Front became, become TRW and TWA, like the Trans World Experian credit agencies. That, I mean, Mike could probably go into some info about the roots of some of these things, like with Bennett and all them other guys, and Bennett Johnson, whatever his name was. There's a bunch of guys that were involved with that stuff. So Mayhew was the other guy, I think, was pretty big with that.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get into a lot of, like, I'm trying to think of the Utah senator and the congressman's name, but they were big time in with that too in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, serving as front men for this Mormon mafia. And they're all, like I said, London agents. They were all trained in London too. That's another thing.
Really?
The original 12 apostles. The original 12 apostles, if you look, like Brigham Young in 1838, they were all trained in London.
Well, guys, go back into the financial dealings of none other than Willard Romney.
Yeah, you know, George Romney's an old author in England, and that was one of the Knights of the Garter, and that Romney family comes from that. So this is an old legacy family, like an old crown. Same with the Randolphs. They married into the Churchills. They're part of the bloodline, too.
Go into Romney's father a little bit. I'm not familiar with his financial dealings.
Well, go ahead, Chris.
Oh, I was going to say, I know Mitt Romney was big with Bain and all that, but his dad was a governor in Michigan. So this guy was big on the political scene. He ran for president in 68. He was in charge of a lot of monetary things, like with the HUD and the Great Society stuff, too. So he had a lot of irons in the fire. And just, man, he could probably go on with a lot of things.
Which corporation was the one that brought Rush Limbaugh out of California to national prominence and paid him $1 million a week?
Oh, yeah, right. Wasn't that them too?
The Bain Corporation.
Bain. Really? Yeah. Yeah, Netanyahu used to work for them too.
Still does.
Yeah, I bet. I bet he probably does. You know, it seems to be a lot of ties to Israel they don't seem to mention either, but that's a strange meeting in the aisles that you can get into as well with that.
Well, I remember I gave programs within the past 4 years. I won't say what city, but I gave programs at Masonic Lodges on constitutional issues. And I found it ironic at both of those lodges was prominently displayed the Star of David.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And they use the Hebrew dating system for all their dates as well. And, you know, I noticed, too, when I took that tour of the Mormon, the giant regional Mormon temple building, there were Stars of David all over that building as well. And, of course, you know, in Mormonism, you know, they're always talking about Zion this and Zion that. So there's quite a connection there. And, you know, Joseph Smith was sort of revealed to be a huckster on some levels because – if you recall, he had these golden tablets that he claimed were these Egyptian tablets, or Egyptian scrolls, I mean. And but he had possession of these before any of the hieroglyphics were translated. They hadn't discovered the Rosetta Stone at that point. And so he made up this whole story about what these hieroglyphics said on his scrolls. and that all related to Mormonism and the Archangel Moroni and all this stuff. But after the hieroglyphics were translated, it turns out everything he said about those scrolls were completely wrong, and that he had made it all up.
Oh, tell me it's not so.
It's like most cults, man. They just tell people what they want to believe, and people literally line up and either want to serve as leaders or followers, but it's a strange dynamic. Look what they were doing with Jimmy Jones out of MKUltra and the CIA, and like, you know, Moscone and Dianne Feinstein were all over that type of stuff, and you don't hear any mention of these type of things going on, not only with the military, but the private sector, the Mossad, and the CIA, and even Ivy League schools like Harvard. Like, we didn't get a chance to get into that yesterday, but, man, amazing, these meetings in the aisles.
Well, and you know, earlier Mike and I and some others were talking about the how the Masons, you know, help each other, which isn't inherently bad. It's just it's funny how it's all relegated to their fellow brethren. But you know, years ago, back when I was living above the Bay Area in Northern California, I was researching into Freemasonry quite heavily, and I learned some of these Masonic handshakes that they had. You know, I have some of these old books that had the Masonic handshakes in them. And one time we were at this fancy hotel in San Francisco, and we needed to get a taxi to go to a different part of the city. And so just as an experiment, I gave the valet guy, the head guy at the stand, the guy that was running the, you know, the courtesy, you know, department, I gave him a Masonic handshake to him and said, "Hey, I need to get a taxi." And he goes, "Oh, hey, no, we're going to get you a private limo. Don't worry. And it'll be for the same price, too." And he gave me a big smile. And I'll always remember that. It was so strange. And sure enough, we got a private limo instead.
Get off the hook from parking tickets, too, Dave.
True story.
No, I'm just doing the old, you know, the rigmarole. Yeah, that's funny.
Giuseppe, why don't you jump in, man? We haven't heard from you in a while.
It's a... I'm looking at a chart of how many Supreme Court justices since John Jay were Freemasons. It's quite a long list.
Really?
Surprise, Mike.
Mike would know that better than any of us, I think. Holy cow. I mean, it looks like four of the original Supreme Court justices were Freemasons at the same time in 1789. John Jay, John Rutledge, William Cushing and John Blair Jr. Then William Paterson jumped in 1793. Oliver Ellsworth, the Chief Justice, 1796. Next Chief Justice was a Freemason. Holy cow, they had a lot of control.
Yeah, so they held the majority literally when it came into inception, the judicial branch.
Yeah, look at that.
Wow, good find, Giuseppe. Mike, what's your take on that?
Well, that to me is just accepted. I find nothing unusual about that. A great study, and possibly we could jump into it sometime, is when Lincoln decided to expand the Supreme Court and his nominees and who they happened to be and what positions they held.
Well, do you know if Lincoln was a Mason? Because I've seen pictures of him doing the hidden hand before.
I am not sure. I have looked at that, and I was going to ask you, Dave, you said you've done tours of the District of Criminals, and Giuseppe, you're right there. Have either of you guys, or even Chris or DW, have you ever taken a tour of the Lincoln Memorial?
No, I haven't.
No, well, I've been there, but I didn't take the tour.
I've been through that tour a couple times.
Mm-hmm. I think what's remarkable about the Lincoln Monument, though, is that the throne that he is sitting upon, his hands are resting on two fasci.
Yeah, so much larger than life.
So, well,
about the basement, Mike, that sounds like an interesting story.
Yeah, it is an interesting story. Most people don't know that there's a basement in the Lincoln Memorial. Sometimes you get there. Were any of you gentlemen, did you take the elevator?
I've never been in the basement. I got to tour it a couple times when I moved out here in the late 80s, but I didn't get the VIP tour or anything.
Well, my tour wasn't conducted. It was a surreptitious decision to see where that elevator went, the handicapped elevator, see where it went. And I took it to the basement and opened the door and was amazed at exactly what I could see before I was very quickly ushered out and told I had made a mistake. I shouldn't be there.
What did you see?
The suspense is killing us, Mike. Come on. You can't do this to us.
I have to keep you guys hanging on for something. Hey.
Hey, Chris. It was the room in the Raiders of the Lost Ark. That's what it was at the end of the movie. Yeah.
Oh, it's great, Mike.
Okay, welcome back to hour number three, the third and final hour of Operation Scorpio. I'm here with Giuseppe from the District of Criminals, Chris Weinert, a.k.a. Brutal Honesty, Mr. Mike Gaddy, the rebel madman himself, and Daryl Wayne. And right before the top of the hour, we've all been sitting on the edge of our chairs to hear about the basement story inside the Lincoln Monument. So, Mike, please tell us before we lose all our cool. What happened?
It was just a nice place to visit, guys. I would like to find out if there's anyone else who's even aware that there's a basement in the Lincoln Memorial. There is when I was there, and that was in the 1980s, there were a suite of offices there that I could find no connection to anywhere, and even the Park Service told me that they were unaware that that was there. So, and I do know that there was an escape panel that at least I was told by someone I trust that there was an escape panel out of there down to the Potomac River, which isn't that far away. Nothing really super sinister, guys.
So when the elevator opened up, what did you see?
A hallway with some offices, and evidently when the elevator dings, it sets off some kind of alarm, because I had a person to make sure that I got right back on that elevator very quickly.
Was this a uniformed person or just a guy in a suit?
This was a guy in a casual attire, actually.
Hmm. And there weren't any symbols on the wall?
No, I saw nothing. Just I was surprised that there was a hallway with doors on both sides of the hallway.
Interesting. Yeah. Daryl, why don't you jump in, man? What's your thoughts on the secret passageways beneath Washington, D.C.?
Well, as Mike was describing it, it sounds like the beginning of the movie with Men in Black, where the guy walks in there and there's a security guard sitting there. And I don't know if Mike's familiar with that movie or not, with the intro of the Men in Black, the secret terrestrial space force. So, I had an interesting conversation here Friday with a lawyer, a common law lawyer, he's in his mid-60s and has been a practicing lawyer for working with other lawyers his whole life, for the most part. He still conducts cases and works with the municipal courts and state courts, and we got off on this conversation, and he made it perfectly clear to me that you don't sit on a judge's seat in the temple, in their temple, which is your municipal and administrative courts, unless you're a Freemason. Now,
interesting, and temple bar is the sort of the home of office or the home, center worldwide for for lawyers.
Right. So the reason I bring this out is because it's so pertinent to your daily life on this very day and going forward as you interact with these municipalities that they're administrated by Freemasons. You don't rise up in the law enforcement game, that click, past the level of sergeant unless you know the secret handshake. So it's undeniable, but this has its origins in Freemasonry. And we are living through its administration right at this very moment. And it is really quite important to, I believe what I would like to communicate to people is that Freemasonry and its administrators in civil government have been the gatekeepers and the bureaucrats that have taken us on this long march, this travel, that have made sure that administratively we've come to the point where we're at. And that's all within their fraternity. And this is why they're not publicized. This is why they're not spoke of. The only time that you have any awareness of it is when they're riding their goofy cars and little bicycles around and doing philanthropic work. So this is a total bait switch on people's perception to make you believe that they're irrelevant. Well, they're not. So.
Hey, did Mert say anything about the ladies that wear the clown gowns? What fraternity or sorority are they in?
Eastern Star?
Well, that's the Eastern Star. Eastern Star.
Okay.
And yeah, notice it isn't the Southern Star, the Western Star, the Northern Star. It's the Eastern Star. And why is that? Well, it's the Eastern Star is where they look for the morning star. And the morning star is where they look for to their enlightenment, to become illumined. This is the whole process. So thank you for the easy softball and the setup. So I'm going to give you the compressed down and dirty. I'm just going to dump it in your lap. Capitalism is a setup. Communism is a setup. These are foils. These are the opposites. These are the dialectics they use to play your brain with. And they play one off the other and have for the last 250 years to bring about what they're bringing about now is the birth of Illuminism. Okay? You're watching the birth and moving into the age of Aquarius with Illuminism. This is all esoteric and the occult. To you, not to them, and they simply are on this pathway that Chris referred to it earlier as the fellow travelers and the long march. And there's actual relationships with. If you go back and study the works of Trotsky and Lenin and any number of Marx is a Mason. Engels is a Mason. If you go back and look at their writings and who they collaborate with, there's all these strands of masonry and fraternity involved in these discourses and dialogues. And also the ideologies, the language. So Marx absolutely knew that communism wasn't viable. If you've actually read his works, you understand that he's just using this as a method of transitioning the society into a point where they capitulate. It's futile. Albert Pike say about all this? Albert Pike says in his letter to Manzini The bottom line is they're going to fight themselves to exhaustion and accept what we give them.
They'll, Daryl,
the Christians, and yeah, go ahead.
I have a question for you. Do you view Illuminism as the esoteric implementation understood by those implementing it, and then the merging of Zio-capitalism and communism into communitarianism as the functional implementation for the Goyim cattle to live it with no idea that it's Illuminism?
Yeah, I think that's a that's actually a very good synopsis. Yeah, that I would say that's a good, that'd make a really good PowerPoint. Yeah,
but so department. It's like, you know, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing, and these seem like innocuous things, and in many cases they are to the low level people. But as you get initiated, there's different like keywords and buzzwords that appeal to levels of information of the people that are hearing this, and maybe one low level Mason will hear one thing, but the high level guys will know this means something different. And this is like the language they utilize. You know, these multi level things. They use the same thing with the yeah. Bible, other things like that too.
That's a great point, well, Chris.
Manly Hall was the great. He was a 33 degree level Mason, Manly P. Hall, and he was described as the historian for the for Masonry. And one of his quotes is simply this: that the new man will go into the future. He says, "The new man will go into the future. You will be extreme." Into the new age. The new man will go only, and his number is the number of 666. The illuminated man only has a future in the future. You are battling against the incomprehensible. Well, talk about spilling the beans, right? This is Manly P. Hall, 33 degree level, historical Freemason. So, yeah.
Go ahead. A number of his books, and one book that I always found to be really fascinating was America's Secret Destiny. And in that, it's not a very long book. It's only maybe 150, 200 pages. But in that book, he reveals very clearly that America was set up exclusively for the purpose of this long march that you talked about, Daryl, and that the America always had a Freemasonic purpose to it, which was to bring the world to this through this long march, and that the world would be ruled by a council of so-called wise men, and that was the grand plan all along.
Well, that's my understanding of it too. That's what I extract from all my studies. And I think that at this point, this correlates almost perfectly with the new information that Michael's brought out about Freemasonry and the so-called progenitors. I don't really like to call them fathers, the progenitors of this thing called this Constitution, the Federalist Constitution. And so I, you know, you can show people the evidence, and I guess they get to reach their own conclusions. And so far, all I have to say to those people that deny the obvious is that you've been wrong. And when do you repent from your wrongness? Okay, when do you even stop moving in the wrong direction? We haven't even done that yet. We're still continuing to slide. We're still walking towards the precipice. A lot of people have already gone over it, and they're just dragging more people with them. They haven't even stopped. So this is problematic, and I think I just sort of segued myself there. So I'll stop.
Well, it's interesting, Daryl, because this all goes back to Mike's original question: is why is this not allowed to be talked about in academia, or on television, or, you know, or just on in basic discussions, this is pretty much verboten, and you just are not allowed to go there for whatever reason.
Well, that's to answer that question, to answer, for us to be informed and knowledgeable and the exacting history and the participants and their actions thereof would be counter to their plans. We would, in that fact, if in fact we were informed, we would, people of conscience would work against it and not be compliant, complacent, and complicit. I call it the three C's. You're either compliant, complacent, or complicit. Okay, well, which one are you? And so they want to appeal to, this is what secret information and agendas do. This, they want to appeal to your psychology and provide the path where you can receive the benefit of being a U.S. citizen and believing a lie and still keeping your good conscience. Well, how's that working out for you, Mr. and Mr. America? How's that working out for you? So anyway, I better be careful. I'm on the edge of being rude here. So
now people need to hear this stuff, man. You're not being rude. You're being righteous here.
So, you know, we have, I'll put this in just very pragmatic terms here for people, for those that profess and espouse to be followers of the Christ. You better repent, and you better start with your political repentance. You have to politically repent and turn away from being complicit. Repent for the purpose of being complicit in the crimes. Okay, you have to stop this, and you have to walk away from your benefit. Okay, because if you don't, you very soon, and some people already are experiencing the horrific effects of this deception and lie. And I don't know how many more, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, nay, yet millions are going to have to perish soon before you. Okay. What is your price? What is your price? Some people are going to go cheap and already have. They're very cheap. Okay. And some of us are going to be very expensive. Okay, but everybody's going to be challenged on what your price is. So I wrote this down today. I was going to save it for you later, Chris, but I'm going to shoot it out now. What's happening here is this is the plan. This is how it works, and this is your future for the rest of this duration of this thing called the U.S. They're going to bribe you. They're going to shame you. I like the word you used, Chris, tokenize you. They will tokenize it. And when that's done working, they're going to move into extorting you and enforcing it, right? And this is your future. So you don't have anything to lose right now, ladies and gentlemen. It's already been lost. So you might as well take a defiant stand right now. And the perfect opportunity is when it comes to the point where you have to pay your tithing to Zion here in April. They call this a federal income tax. Well, why are you doing that? Joe Biden is so legitimate and credible you 78 million people are going to go ahead and tithe your resources and energy to these people so they can redistribute it. Okay. So I'm done ripping now, Chris.
Here.
I'm done ripping for
that's
the moment.
Pretty good rip.
Oh, this is beautiful, man. Let it rip.
Here.
Yeah.
Oh, that was great.
So, that was great.
Go ahead, Giuseppe.
I was going to say, fantastic, man. It's crazy, but what we're witnessing literally the last 110 years or so, especially, or maybe even especially the last 40 years, is the classic allegory of you put a frog in lukewarm water and slowly turn up the heat, and it will just lay there and enjoy it and be boiled to death. And that's the American sheeple.
Right. Isn't this hot tub nice, man? Boy, it's nice and warm. This is awesome.
Yeah. There's, and, there's another great analogy here, gentlemen, too, and that is when they train elephants, they put a rope around their foot, and they are unable at an early age to pull that rope loose from the mooring. But as that elephant grows, its mind is so conditioned that it can't pull that rope out, that even with the tremendous strength of a grown elephant, they will not attempt to pull themselves free.
They won't even try. Yeah, I did videos on that a long time ago talking about that dynamic and training circus animals, and that's almost like what they see us as.
Well, that's what they've done to us. Gentlemen, I don't know how to follow up on what you said, DW, but I did want to throw in a few links and sources for people who would like to study this a bit more, and I highly recommend these. And a gentleman by the name of James D. Carter wrote his doctoral dissertation under Professor Walter Prescott Webb, one of the most distinguished American historians of the mid-20th century. And this dissertation was published by the University of Texas Press, and it is called Masonry in Texas. Webb was quite laudatory, and he said, after reading Dr. Carter's book, no one can doubt that Freemasonry has exerted an influence on the nation and the state which cannot and should not be ignored. Carter began his work with the history of colonial lodges in the early 18th century. He included an 80-page chapter on Freemasonry and the American Revolution, and a 30-page chapter on Freemasonry and the United States government. He might have exaggerated somewhat on the number of Masons from my research, which was involved in the formation of the Union, but his basic presumption is correct. The Masons were most influential in the process. The leaders on both sides of the constitutional debate were members of Masonic lodges. There is a problem in knowing precisely how many of the participants were Masons because of the secrecy itself. Lodge membership was not always flaunted by the members, and historians have not paid much attention to the subject. And of course, as I said before, 18 of the 56 signers of the Declaration were Freemasons. 18 of the 39 signers of the Constitution were Freemasons, and possibly some have reduced the number on the Declaration of Independence to 9. But the 13 signers of the Constitution who we know were Masons were Bedford, Blair, Barely, Broome, Carroll, Dayton, Dickinson, Franklin, Gilman, King, McHenry, Patterson, and Washington. Of these, 5 had been or later became Grand Masters. Edmund Randolph was also a major Masonic figure in Virginia and a major figure at the convention. He did not sign the document because of his doubts, although he later supported the ratification at the Virginia Ratification Convention. And he did that because Washington promised him a high position in the government if he would support ratification at the convention. And he did, and this may have been a Mason's agreement, he did support at the Constitutional Convention, actually getting in debates with Patrick Henry to the point several people wrote they thought it was going to end up in a feud. But then after the convention, when the new government was started, Edmund Randolph became the very first Attorney General of the United States. So he was awarded for his switch, philosophical switch. Edmund Randolph had been a former military aide-de-camp for Washington, and he had been the official who signed the charter documents that created Alexandria Lodge No. 39, which was later changed to Alexandria Lodge No. 22, when Washington, as its first charter master, served there as the Grand Master.
That's fascinating, Mike. And, you know, you mentioned Benjamin Franklin, and this goes into another sort of a corollary that there are many quasi-Masonic clubs that are offshoots of Masonry, and of course Benjamin Franklin was a member of the Hellfire Club, and you know, some people say it was just an orgy club and they just like to have wild sex, but you know, there's other evidence that suggests quite strongly that it was something far darker than that.
And the Sisters of the Ninth Circle, Dave. Frankel was also part of the Sisters of the Ninth Circle. He was like part of that thing in France. It was like the French side of the female mysticism, the esoteric. It's kind of like the breeding of this bloodline. It's weird, man. They've always had this type of eugenics program, and it goes back centuries.
Right. There's a question, guys, that I would like to pose before the group for discussion. And that was the Constitution of 1787 a civil covenant modeled along the lines of Masonic theology?
Yeah.
Was it closer to the Masonic ideal than the existing state constitutions? In other words, were the terms of judicial and political discourse shaped by the Masonic worldview at the convention in 1787?
Well, that is a fascinating question. Let's toss that over to Daryl first and see where his mind takes this.
Well, thanks, Dave. I think when you take the Articles of Confederation for the Perpetual Union and line them up and put them side by side with the Constitution and compare them, the distinction becomes obvious. And so the answer to Michael's question would be yes. The subsequent constitution, the federal constitution out of 1787, facilitates a Masonic process. It does so in its vagaries and openness to interpretation. This also facilitates the possibilities of taking advantage of the obscureness or the aspects of a constitution in future proceedings that they're not even sure of what's going to happen, but they have the room to maneuver. The Articles of Confederation the Perpetual Union did not allow them to do that, and specifically the states' constitutions, which ascribed an oath to recognition of God the Father. Did not allow them to do that. So there were two very important aspects that had to be overturned. One was the nation states called New York, Virginia, Florida, Alabama, Iowa, and they had to be subjugated under the federal United States. This was a fait accompli after the Civil War. This was all accomplished. So, yes, Michael, I would say they were following a Masonic agenda.
As a source, and I don't know if any of you gentlemen have read this, but I would highly recommend it. And to any listener, who agrees with us or opposes us, I would, welcome them to read this book, and it is called Christianity and the Secret Teachings of the Masonic Lodge, What Goes On Behind Closed Doors.
Hmm.
And that was published by a Mr. John Ankerberg and John Weldon. And John Ankerberg has an evangelistic association out of Chattanooga, Tennessee. So for people who find themselves on the fence or who believe strongly in either direction, I highly recommend that book for their own edification.
Mike, could you give us a few highlights from that or a Cliff Notes version of what you think are some of the most important points brought out by it?
Well, one of the things, Dave, let's take a look at another book, and that would be a biography of Benjamin Franklin, and it was written by Carl Van Doren, Vandoren. And in that book, I found something very remarkable that he said, and I hope to tie this all together for your question. But in that book, he said, Freemasonry in America has been social and local with little influence in politics. Now, that was the standard view, and to many still is the standard view. And he stated again, and I quote, Masonry was merely clubbery. But the nagging question I think that we have to answer is, what other intercolonial club produced so many leaders during the American Revolution? when we look at the percentages that I've read twice, where is was there who else could have influenced it? Somebody had to influence it. And with that percentage of Freemasons involved in the creation, could we say they had no influence at all, as Mr. Van Doren said in Franklin's biography? Can we say they had no influence? I don't think so. But Masonry is seldom discussed as a factor in American history. It appears only in chapters devoted to the anti-Masonic political party of the 1820s and 1830s. Gentlemen, that also is a good study. We actually had political parties that opposed Freemasonry. And this...
Mike.
Sir,
Mike,
go
wasn't
ahead.
Wasn't Adams the guy that they put in charge of the anti-Masonic party? And, like, wasn't Adams one of the guys that, like, him and Smith, his brother-in-law, the guys that founded the Society of the Cincinnati, and like, what I could argue be, like, the secret society of America, you know, with this bloodline through the founding fathers and this Masonic thing? What are your thoughts on that? Am I all over the place, or does that make sense to you?
Well, here's something. Are you familiar with the conspiracy at Newburgh?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. And who was that? The Order of the Cincinnati?
I believe so, right? It was the Society of Cincinnati, right?
Okay. And what was the building where they met in Newburgh, New York?
Oh, man, you got me. Probably a Mason Hall, but I don't know.
Oh, wow. Ding, ding, ding. We have a winner.
That was a nice stab in the dark there, huh? Work yeah. for Hamlin.
Yeah. You know, that was such a tough question. I think... And I would say this, I think Freemasonry is a missing link in early American historiography.
Oh, no question. Yeah. No question.
More than that, it may be the missing link.
Right. And it's one of the most forbidden topics. You're just not allowed to go there if you're a serious historian. And, you know, the anti-Masonic party was briefly mentioned. And of course, I believe that began after the revelations and the death of Captain Morgan. Have you looked into the anti-Masonic party, and how do you think that fits in to this whole picture?
Well, it's a great study, Dave. And at some point, I think we could probably do, at least on my program, your program, Chris's program, whatever, we could do a program on those parties. I think to do it service, it would require more than a few minutes discussion for those anti-Freemasonry parties.
Hey, Mike, wasn't it Adams, though, that they picked to run for the anti-Masonic thing in 1828? Or was that, or am I incorrect on that?
Are you talking about John Q?
Yeah, John Q. Yes. He ended up losing that one to Jackson, I think.
Yeah, and he was he had been Secretary of State, and he made a great speech in 1823 on July the 4th, which he says America goes not in search of monsters to destroy. Wow, if you believe that anymore. But to make another link is let's look at. This what we're looking at, this dynamic is not only true just of American history. Margaret Jacobs, who observed a similar lack of interest in the Masonic connections in English history, and a quote from her works is that, quote, despite the importance of Freemasonry for the Enlightenment era, of whatever variety, this originally British institution has received scant attention from British academic historians. This is particularly unfortunate. This is a particularly unfortunate gap in the historiography of the 18th century, not only for intellectual, but also for political reasons. But Ms. Jacob is careful to distance herself from any conspiracy theories at all in her work. And she despairingly refers to some of the people who were anti-Masonic. So consistently for a academic consistently misspelled the anti-Masonic folks names in her work. And I think it's important that this is not only an American, but it's also a British leaving it out, omission. That was the word I was looking
for. Sure. Yeah,
and
sometimes it's louder than the words is the silence. Sorry,
exactly. Exactly. Yeah. You're exactly right. But Ms. Jacob hastens to assure her readers and what I've checked into her stuff with this statement and similar statements, but quote, we can now dispense with conspiracy theories and still show the survival throughout the first half of the 18th century of a social world that was often but not necessarily Masonic, wherein some very dangerous ideas were in fact discussed and disseminated. Really? Really?
Hey, Mike, I was going to – oh, sorry, Dave, go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to bring up, you know, there's also a Freemasonic connection that's undeniable to police. I believe Chris brought that up earlier. And, you know, that's why, you know, in England, the cops have, you know, black and white checkered hats because, you know, all the lodges have a checkerboard floor in their ritual room. And, you know, the police cars in the United States are all black and white. And you have the Fraternal Order of Police. These are all very strong references to Freemasonry. And I think Mike said you don't move up the hierarchy very high within that system unless you are a Mason. I think that's pretty undeniable.
Yeah, there's symbols, the triangle and the compass as well. I mean, so yeah. The particular will be. Also, Mike, I was going to point out that Gilman and Carroll were both Freemasons and founding fathers. I would also add that Gilman was Skull and Bones guy with Russell. He founded the Johns Hopkins University, Daniel Coit Gilman, and also Carroll, I think, was the one that founded George Washington University, a political operative haven, a Jesuit infiltrated university as well, and really ties to Rhodes Scholars and things like this. So, man, these meetings in the aisles, it's like coincidence theory for conspiracy, right?
Right. And I love to watch authors, you know, when a person has some knowledge and they read works, and you're not taking that person's words for gospel, but you read something to understand where that person is coming from. With Ms. Jacobs, she also makes this quote. You gentlemen will like this one because she tries to qualify herself, as a lot of people do, and to put themselves on the fence. And she did it with this quote, I think, and it's, quote, it seems not unreasonable to suggest that this social circuit, talking about Freemasonry, was international in scope, while at the same time acknowledging that we still have a very imperfect account of the extent to which some Masonic lodges under certain circumstances would encourage a radical critique of the existing order, unquote.
Wow. She kind of dances right up to the edge there and then turns back. That's interesting. And Mike, you know, your experience within, you know, some of these alphabet agencies, intelligence work, were you ever confronted or suggesting that maybe you should join a lodge, or was that brought up in discussion, or what was your take on that?
Well, most of the places that my superiors suggest I go had nothing to do with a Masonic lodge. I asked too many questions and I was too critical. And right. I remember being called into my supervisor's office at the institution at Fort George G. Meade, Maryland. And I was told to remove a bumper sticker from my pickup truck, which said "Dare to keep the CIA off drugs."
That's funny. Now you have a show, Dare to Think. Out, or maybe we should rename it Dare to Think.
Yeah, Dare to Think yesterday. That was great. Yeah, Dare to Think. Out loud or you know, to
or
yourself.
Otherwise.
Just Dare to Think, yeah.
That's coming next, man. They're starting to tap into people's brain waves and trying to go for that next level psychic tapping into your brain. It's like the last bastion of free speech is in your own mind, and they're trying to like take that from you, too. It's crazy.
Well, I think they've done that with this concrete, keeping everyone at a concrete stage of psychological development. And it, what that does is it allows you to take in information, but you cannot make a critical decision using that information. And, you know, when you talk about the concrete stage of psychological development, we're basically talking about the age group of junior high people. Look around you today. Is that not the mindset of the majority of people we encounter today? Is along the their attitude is basically junior high.
Yeah, and the political spectrum is steering it right into that infantilization too, Mike. That's a great point.
I that always kind of, my wife was one who told me about that, and she was an educator, and she mentioned the fact that education never takes the people involved in the education system being educated, or even those who do the education, never takes them beyond the concrete stage of psychological development.
Right. That's fascinating.
It's like a codependency.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, it's like a codependency they establish, and that's the, one of the natures of it, you know, that they're trying to build.
Oh, yeah. We know from Marx that they intended to build a nation, and, you know, we can go to Skinner and also to Dewey on the educational system and understand that the educational system was never to actually create entrepreneurs. I forgot who it was even addressed that. We do not intend to create entrepreneurs. We intend to create good little worker bees.
Yeah, John D. Rockefeller said, "I want a nation of workers, not a nation of thinkers." And he was, you know, square behind this. Giuseppe, why don't we get your input here, man? Where do you want to take this?
Well, I would like to share one of my favorite Manly P. Hall quotes, which is, "Once men died for truth, but now truth dies at the hands of men."
Ooh. Oh, wow. Amen.
That's a good one.
That is a good one.
First casualty of war, man. First casualty of war.
Yeah. No, it's just been outstanding to hear the thousands of hours of research from Chris and Daryl and Mike and yourself. It's just been a tour de force. Really enjoying it.
And I thought Mike kicked it off in such a great fashion, asking the question, why is this a forbidden topic? Because, you know, if you had truly open ideas, you'd have all kinds of people within academia with different viewpoints on it. But instead, it's just silence.
It's totally how innocence behaves, Dave. You know, they got everything surveilled except for the people that are really the big criminals here.
Yeah. Yeah. Daryl, Daryl, let's hear from you, man. Where does your mind take this?
Well, you guys are so provocative. I just get to sit back a little bit and luxuriate. Listen, let me share with how I think the common man or woman can actually understand when they're hearing truth. Truth lives in a condition of poverty. So you will not hear truth come from people who are being paid, making money on their message. You won't hear it. It will always be compromised. And so truth always requires a sacrifice. There has to be a sacrifice when somebody tells the truth. And this is why you hear so little of it, because most people don't want to sacrifice. They're out for the benefit, and they do not want to be a part of real duty. And this is what you're hearing here today, and you hear it from these gentlemen all the time and different people. But it's not a profitable situation. So if you're trying to find a distinction between where you're hearing truth and where you're just getting your ears tickled, you'll find the truth in the poverty of the people that are presenting it. They're not getting paid. So,
I feel it right in the feels.
Are you guys familiar with Albert J. Knock?
From the Knox family, right? The Secretary of Treasury?
No, this one was a little bit different. Albert J. Knock was a
general.
He wrote probably the best biography of Thomas Jefferson available anywhere back in the 1920s, over 100 years ago. And he was very objective about Jefferson. He was the first book that I read that actually did not present Jefferson as a wonderful sainted hero. He pointed out his flaws as well as his greatest accomplishments. But Albert J. Knock also wrote a beautiful piece called Isaiah and the Remnant. And you guys just really hit that, where he talked about Isaiah in the Bible, and where Isaiah, where God told Isaiah to go out because King Uzziah had created a mess like we have today in this country, and had just, and so God tells Isaiah, I'm paraphrasing here, I'm not quoting scripture, and he tells Isaiah, go out and teach the people, show them what everything is happening, show them that this thing is just absolutely corrupt, much like what we try to do on a weekly basis, show them what's going on. And you know, and Isaiah says, well, yes, Lord, I'll do whatever you want me to do. And then God says, well, Isaiah, but I got to tell you, they ain't going to listen. And Isaiah says, well, then why am I doing this? And then God says, because I have a remnant that needs to hear your words. You won't know who they are. It's not important that you know who they are. It's only important that they hear the truth. That is all that's important. That's your entire task. And so Isaiah says, well, how will I know if I'm doing a good job? And so God says to Isaiah, well, if you find a lot of people showing up to hear you and you start making a lot of money, you're doing it wrong.
Well, and this sort of goes back to something that Daryl said on a previous show, talking about the curse of Cassandra, where Cassandra was able to prophesize the future, but the curse was that nobody would listen to her. And, you know, Daryl, I thought you made a really important point earlier where, you know, repentance is important. And there is a great divide being created right now between people who are going to go along with this system that essentially is going to be about as close as we'll ever see to the so-called mark of the beast system, where you will not be able to buy, sell, or trade without this mark on you. And they're already revealing that to the public in many ways, and people are going to have to make some very hard choices as to whether or not they're going to go along with that, go along to get along, mm-hmm. or stand up to it.
Yeah, well, the test of the character of what we're talking about is not coming. It is here. We are here now, and I would like to reinforce your words and what I said earlier, and that if you espouse yourself, you tell others and present an image of being somebody of principle, okay, this is what whoever does, and you only fight for that principle when you can win, you're a fraud. You're a prostitute. And this will be the gut check that is upon this people now. You're being tested and weighed and measured. And by the way, you will not get a second chance. So take it to heart, boys and girls. Fight them now. Or you, because you won't have the ability or the opportunity to later.
Yeah,
I agree, man. I agree.
Yeah, we're you're right, man. We're in it now. This isn't something coming in the future. And you know, researching conspiracy stuff was always so much more enjoyable when it was something that was going to happen far off in the future sometime. But here we are, and we're living it now in real time.
You mean like the rapture? Like the rapture? You know, I don't have to do anything because I'm out of here.
Yeah,
that's right. That's QAnon. You don't have to do anything. You just kind of wait. You know, I'm such a ruiner because I don't believe in these Jewish Zionist fairy tales, and you know, but I'm even called an atheist. But I believe in God. I totally am picking up what you're putting down, Daryl. I agree with you 100%. This is the merchants of soul being tested against really the fate of humanity. And if we go along with this and we allow this to continue, yeah, it's not going to look good. And you guys are just nailing it, man. I'm just glad to be a part of this conversation. So thank you.
Hey, Chris, let me add something there that hit me. I think I mentioned it on the program yesterday that hit me. I had a gentleman say that he fully and totally believed what, you know, that Casey, CIA Director Casey, said in 1981, we will know our disinformation program is complete when everything the American public believes is false. He said he totally believed that. But he fully and totally believed QAnon.
Wow, what a disconnect. Unbelievable.
That's like you're saying, though, that inability to process and comprehend what you're learning. It's an emotional cul-de-sac, like an intellectual one, too.
Well, on Thursday night, I had my co-host tell me, I asked him a question, do you believe that the deep state controls both parties? And he said, oh, absolutely. There's no doubt about that. And then I said, well, then why do you disagree with me that the deep state put Trump in office?
No doubt. Alex Jones is legit, man.
Take a pill.
Yeah. Giuseppe, why don't you jump in, man? What's your take on this now?
Well, I've been meditating deeply to try and bring something new, and I'm channeling a little Manly P. Hall update, and the quote now should read, once men died for truth, but now truth dies at the hands of men who allow their anuses to be swabbed as well.
Picture.
I doubt he even saw this come, but you never know.
Hey, Giuseppe, if you're gonna quote Manly P. Hall, I'm gonna quote Ezra Pound.
Great.
And, your daily Ezra Pound. And Ezra Pound simply said to the English and the Americans, but mostly to the English, from his radio platform in Italy during World War II, he says, you have lost yourselves unto yourselves. And this is what we find the condition of the population in this country at present. They have lost themselves unto themselves.
And you know, Ezra Pound was truly a genius on so many different levels. And, you know, of course, he spent 13 years in St. Elizabeth's mental hospital for those radio broadcasts you're referring to, because he was actually charged with treason and under penalty of death. And his lawyer convinced him to accept a plea of insanity, which what an
charged
incredible
by traitors,
story.
Dave. Sorry to interrupt you, but charged right. by traitors.
Hey, could I read one last thing that I had in my notes? And I really want to get this out there. If you guys will indulge me this one short paragraph.
But please do, Mike. Go ahead.
Okay. Washington's first inauguration is especially revealing. On April the 30th, 1789, Washington took the oath of office as President of the United States, administered by Chancellor Robert R. Livingston, Grand Master of the Grand Lodge of New York. General Jacob Morton, Worshipful Master of St. John's Lodge in New York City, the oldest lodge in the city, and Grand Secretary of the Grand Lodge of New York, was Marshal of the inauguration. It was one of his duties to provide a Bible for the occasion. Morton brought from the altar of St. John's Lodge the Bible upon which Washington placed his hand while repeating the obligation to uphold the Constitution of the United States, and then kissed the sacred volume to complete the ceremony. You will not read in textbooks that 33 of Washington's generals were all Freemasons, and there were 10 military lodges within the Revolutionary Army. I'm done.
Wow, that's astounding. And I believe, I think he took the oath on a Masonic Bible, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it came from the Masonic Lodge.
Right. And that's significant, very symbolic. We're down this the last couple of minutes, so I want to give everybody a chance to have a final thought. Let's start with Daryl, because Daryl, you have brought forth some very heavy information today, and I think you're spot on. Why don't you go ahead first, sir?
Well, I just want to take the opportunity to say thank you, as always, to get some of this information out there. I always try to find remedies. There's a purpose for what I try to do. Sometimes I'm more successful with it than others, even with myself. But I'm always trying to find a remedy. So I'm optimistic. And I would just say that the only course of action that I believe that any of us have any control over whatsoever is yourself. And if you are not the change that you want to see in others, you might as well just give it up. You have to be the change that you want to see in others. So you will have to this will cost you something. So if you say you're a patriot, whatever that means to you, or a Christian, whatever that means to you, and you have not paid a price for it, you need to completely rethink your basis for making decisions, okay? Because I guarantee you, if it's not costing you something, you ain't there yet.
Man, Daryl, that is both thought-provoking and inspiring. And I'd just like to say that I'm honored to be a part of this conversation. That's my final thought. Chris, why don't you take us on out? I don't think we have much time.
Hold on. I need to drop an Ezra Pound quote that I'm fond of. A slave is one who waits for someone to come and free him.
Wow.
Hear, hear. Hear, hear, hear.
Wow. Yeah. Awesome. Pay the cost to be the boss. James Brown, right?
Okay, Chris, why don't you take us on out, man?
Okay, that's what I thought I was doing, man. Back to you.
No, well, what's your final thought? Do you have one?
Oh, that was it, man. Paid the cost to be the boss. That's it. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Keep it short and sweet. I'm trying to move it along. You know, I'm already taking up all the time trying to let these guys go.
Okay, well, I guess I'll end with let's everyone please step up and keep this bastion of free speech going, Revolution Radio. There aren't many left, and this is truly a platform where the hosts are allowed to say what they want without any restrictions. Except OF. That's a freedom. Okay. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.